Americans. This is the Urbane Cowboys Podcast with Josiah Neely of R Street Institute and Doug McCullough of Lone Star Policy Institute. Good day.
Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Urbane Cowboys Podcast. I'm Josiah Neely with R Street Institute.
And I'm Doug McCullough with the Lone Star Policy Institute.
Today, we're going to be talking about water and water policy, water scarcity, particularly in the West, out in California, places like that. And to join us and help guide our discussion, we have my R Street colleague, Steve Greenhut, who is a senior fellow and the Western Regional Director for the R Street Institute. He's also the author of several books, the latest of which is Winning the Water Wars. California can meet its water needs by promoting abundance rather than managing scarcity. So, Steve, welcome to the program.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
So, this is an interesting book. We want to kind of delve into it. But before we get to that, it would probably be good if you could tell us a little bit about your background. You obviously work at a think tank now, but you have a background in journalism and other stuff. So tell us a little bit about Steve.
Okay. I have been a California journalist for 20 some years. I'm on the Southern California News Group editorial board. So I write columns for the Orange County Register and LA Daily News and 10 other papers. And I spent most of my career at the Orange County Register as an editorial writer, columnist, deputy editor. Also was a covered the Capitol for the San Diego Union Tribune, and basically a longtime California journalist. I wrote a previous book called Plunder, the subtly titled book Plunder, about public employees and the pension issue, and a previous one called Abuse of Power, which was about California's redevelopment agencies and the abuse of eminent domain by local governments. So I was even a Better Homes and Gardens magazine remodeling editor years ago. So I have a bunch of journalistic experience.
And I would say that if you were going to write a book critical of public employee unions and pensions and that sort of thing, you never have to worry about being lonely.
Because plenty to write about.
Let's talk about the book. It's about water issues. You focus on California. I think some of the issues probably have broader applications in other, other Western states. But what's the overall situation in California with regard to water?
A lot of the Easterners we know. When we go back to our headquarters in D.C. I mentioned that I write about water. You can see people's eyes glaze over because back east, obviously, water is just something that is there and there's plenty of it. And usually sometimes there's too much of it. California, it's our whole development of the state is based on our access to water. And we have a state of almost 40 million people. We can't quite hit 40 million because people keep moving to your state, it seems. But we're almost at 40 million people, and the whole development of the state was based on our access to water. And we have, over the years, turned our state largely into a giant plumbing system to meet those needs. So we have the Sierra Nevada mountains on the east, which the snowpack is one of our major sources of water. And we have a system of dams through the federal Central Valley Project and the state water project and canals that feed water all around the state. So what we end up doing is fighting over who gets which portion of this water. And in the earlier days of our development, I go into a lot of the history in the book. There was this kind of can-do attitude, of we're going to build the infrastructure needed to meet the needs of a growing population. And, California, we had that attitude in all sorts of areas. Former Governor Pat Brown was, known for ushering in California's golden age, which with its education system and freeways. And we had this kind of attitude towards the golden state attitude of the California dream. And in the ensuing years, for a variety of reasons, we haven't been maintaining any of our infrastructure in any of those areas, including water, and we haven't been expanding it significantly. And the population is about double what it was in the 70s, which was the last time we built any major water infrastructure. So we're just kind of fighting over what's there and who gets it. And about 50% of the state's water just flows unimpeded to the sea. Now, that doesn't mean, as some people say, it's wasted, but it's all just flows to the sea. And then we fight the agricultural interest fight, and urban and residential uses are around 10% of the water. That's what we're fighting over. And a lot of our policymakers seem to just want conservation, conservation, only conservation. Nothing wrong with conservation, but we're like fighting over drops of water. And the main theme of the book is if we took a policy that was geared towards abundance through a variety of the policies I detail in the book, and I know you've written about, Josiah, we can save more water during wet years and have it during dry years. And there seems to be this environmental ethic that almost wants to see rationing, and that, you know, rationing by humans. So it's become this fish versus people battle. And the book is designed to try to break us out of what the environmentalists call those binaries.
Yeah, it is interesting. One of the interesting things, if you look at water law or water, you know, water rights in the United States, you can kind of draw a line down the middle of the country. And in the eastern half of the country, water rights are based on, I guess they're called riparian, which basically means, you know, anyone can use water next to their property a reasonable amount, whatever it is, right? You know, so you just do, because they have plenty of water there, I guess. And by contrast, in the West, it's a totally different basis for the law. It's a so-called prior appropriation system, which is, you know, whoever got there first and started using water for something, you know, someone else can't come along later and start, even if they're upstream, start using it for something, for a different purpose or whatnot. And I guess, you know, fundamentally, it's because water is more scarce in the West. And of course, as you know, as we know from economics, a key way to deal with scarcity is through prices, right? Markets. And then, of course, a different way to do it is through, as you mentioned, government rationing. How much of the one are we using, and how much of the other are we using to try and deal with the water scarcity issue in California?
Well, yeah, California makes things even more complicated, as we always do, by recognizing both forms of water rights. and then there's one set of prior appropriation rights. I forget the date prior to a particular date, and then a different set after. So yeah, what we end up is with this government control of water, which some of it, you know, it's kind of was a little bit of a hard book as a libertarian, right? Because we're dealing with an infrastructure system that was created almost entirely by government and is run almost entirely by government. But I know as we discussed when I was working on the book, the pricing issue that you point out is key. You know, that would be the better way to encourage people to use water more, you know, use it at its highest and best use, and to conserve water rather than just having these government restrictions and limits. And I have this in the book. I put this decision tree in there. It's one of those Rube Goldberg like graphs where to do this, you have to do that, and all these little boxes and charts and arrows. And that's the decision tree for getting government approval to buy and sell water. So that we technically allow the sale of water, but make it so bureaucratically impossible to achieve that it's hard, you know, it's hard to get pricing. So, you know, we largely argue over. So that's one of the, I go into the Australia tried a pricing model, and actually I'd be interested in your thoughts on it. Because in their pricing model, I have problems with it. I like the idea that they tried to price water so that even the government has to buy its share of water. But they did it from like a cap and trade perspective. So it's kind of like our California's cap and trade energy system or emission system, where companies are given a cap and a falling cap, and then they buy and sell credits so that until they're able to push their pollution levels down. So they start by capping the amount of water, and then everybody fights over the pricing of the remaining amount of water. And what happens, though, is government always has so much money and power that the government is muscling out the private users of the water. So that's not an idea, although I appreciate their efforts to have some sort of pricing system. I don't know, Josiah, have you looked at that system at all in Australia?
I have a little bit. And my main takeaway of the Australian system is it seemed it seemed overly complicated, which it does, but our system is also overly complicated in its own way. It certainly would be kind of a fundamental. You would basically have to throw out hundreds of years of American law and regulation and conceptualization of water in order to do it quite the way they do in Australia, I think. It's not exactly a perfect system there. One of the big surprising things to me about water rights, and you mentioned it, that they are a tradable commodity. You can buy and sell these water rights, but normally, you buy a car from someone, it's like, say you have someone who, they had a car and they're using the car to get to and from work, right? And you want to buy a car so you can drive it cross country, for pleasure or whatever. That's fine. No one cares, what the use is that you're putting it to. But with water rights, the way it works is your right is restricted to a certain type of use. So if someone has a water right that they have been using water in order to, grow some sort of crop, alfalfa or whatever, and someone else comes along, maybe they have a microchip factory and they need water to keep keep things cool there, or maybe it's a city that wants to buy water for municipal use or whatever. That's a big hassle just trying to change the use, because the use is restricted. It would not just be a water right, but it would be a water right for agricultural use.
Right. It becomes
there are all sorts of.
Yeah, it becomes subjective and subject to court disputes. And the problem there is, like, if I'm selling a stock today or a piece of real estate, I want to sell it based on the market now, not have to wait 8 months to see if I get an approval when the market may have changed in its entirety. So that's part of the problem. Now, in Australia, they have strict growth controls. I mean, they do something called land releases. They try... It's a country that's the size of the continental U.S. and has what's it have, like 10% of our population, the population's extremely urban because they kind of cram, they limit the release. Yep. So maybe a pricing system is going to work differently there than it is in a place like the United States, where we've built the infrastructure throughout the West. And where we've dammed our rivers, and we have the kind of snowpack that they don't get. I don't think they have the mountain ranges we have. So it's a little bit different, but the idea of pricing's good. But I agree with I quote the Western Governors Association, which advocates for a better pricing in Western water and a simpler process for buying and selling it, including, some sort of market system that could tell you the price of water instantaneously. But it also needs to be done against the backdrop of building new infrastructure, taking care of the infrastructure we have, which is something California is terrible at. We almost had the you know, the spillway disaster at Lake at Oroville Dam a couple of years ago, which led to the evacuations of like 200,000 people. So we need to build up our infrastructure and embrace a lot of policies some private water development policies. Our state officials have been stopping the Cadiz water project from tapping an aquifer the size of Rhode Island in the Mojave Desert under what seemed to be bogus environmental concerns. I mean, I'm not unconcerned about the environment, but with the California Environmental Quality Act makes it extremely easy to file lawsuits against any sort of project that could have any impact on the environment. And it does seem as if the goal, based on reading the opponent's statements, seems to be growth control. They don't want more water because that's going to encourage the kind of growth, that they're tired of having. So, along the Central Coast in Santa Barbara, it took a severe drought before people there wanted to even tap into the state water project. But so when we're not building this kind of infrastructure we need, and I'm not calling for building massive new dams. I mean, there are a couple dam projects that have been on the books for 20 years or more that seem like they'd be useful. One of them's an off-stream project.
This is a family show.
What's that? I missed that, Josiah.
I said, you're talking about a damn project. Watch your language. This is a family show.
You know, so there was a plan to expand Shasta Dam by 18.5 feet. The dam was designed to be 200 feet taller than it is now. And yet that got stifled. These couple projects like Sites Reservoir, Temperance Flats have been on the books for a long time. Those could be built. Desalination, before we got started here, Doug was and I were talking about Israel, and they've solved their real water problems. I mean, they're existential water problems. The Six-Day War was fought over, over water access in part by desalination. Now, it's an expensive form of water. But the proposed desalination plan in Huntington Beach right now in Southern California in Orange County is being held up by the California Coastal Commission over concerns about plankton. And one of the groups opposing that project said something to the effect of, well, you know, the Pacific isn't a limitless resource. Well, actually, it is not.
I thought the oceans were rising.
Yeah. I mean, it is. Kind of a limitless resource, right? I mean, and a few plankton around one plant in one part of the Pacific Ocean is it's hard to believe that the motives are about plankton and the motives really aren't about growth control. And so that leaves us fighting over over diminishing amounts of water. So you, Josiah, you referred me, I think, to the pseudonymous blogger Scott Alexander. And
yes.
He did a pretty good analysis, and he was explaining that if all the savings from rationing conservation amount to 20% of residential use, that only amounts to 10% of the water we use to irrigate alfalfa in the state. And here's a quote that I love from him. He said, "I realize that people paying subsidies to misuse water to grow unprofitable crops and then offering them counter subsidies to not take your first set of subsidies is, to say the least, a very creative way to spend government money. But the point is, it's better than what we're doing now, right?" So that kind of gives an idea of the need for pricing and kind of the insanity of our current policy. And we could, if we promote wastewater recycling, which Orange County is doing a fabulous job on, and desalination, and strategic improvements and expansions of our infrastructure, we can catch enough water to meet all our needs rather than having water cops and the kind of things that some of the environmentalists are pushing for.
I was going to ask about the desalination. I know you've already teed this up, but I guess what else is an obstacle to desalination? Because, I mean, it seems to me you've got the ocean right there. And I know I've read some of the write-ups about your book, and you talk about abundance. It seems like if you can do this at a large enough scale that you have created that abundance, you've created all the water that you could possibly need. you've mentioned that it's costly, but what are some of the other the obstacles to more large scale desalination?
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly political. I mean, there's a plant that's proposed in a town called Marina, which is near Monterey, on the Monterey Bay. And basically that area had been growing, and it has a desperate need for water. And the current water use is actually draining, I think, the Carmel River and causing, a lot of genuine environmental destruction. And the desal plant would provide enough water even to restore the river. But environmental groups are presenting a environmental justice argument, because Marina is a relatively lower income community. It really isn't that much of a low income community, but they're arguing that the placement of it is going to impact the community. But most of these plants are placed on previous industrial sites that already exist. The one in Orange County was proposed to be built on an old electrical generating station, and I just think some of these environmental arguments are almost irrational. So there's always an economic argument.
People work at the plants, right?
What's that?
People work at the plants. They have jobs there. We're talking about, like, what's the impact on the community?
Oh, I know, right? Good jobs, water, and it helps the environment. And it seems like a sensible thing. Now, there's a cost issue. I mean, right now, desalinated water is more expensive than imported water. But, that price, there's a price compression going on. I mean, desalination is becoming more cost effective, and other forms of water are becoming more costly. And Josiah, you know a lot more about this than me, but on the electricity grid, I mean, the utilities will sometimes pay for a higher cost form of electricity because of its consistency. So you're going to pay more for X form of electricity, but you know it's going to be there all the time. And the same thing with desal, where it's easy to plan that amount of water. So that would, Doug, you're right. I mean, that would be a big help to be able to build those facilities. And they're mostly private investments there. And then some of those private things, like I had mentioned, like the Cadiz project, water recycling, the environmentalists aren't opposed to that. And that's an amazing thing. It's just, I know when San Diego tried it years ago, it was one of the brewing companies I had read kind of circulated the term toilet to tap. And the reason was they had they were concerned that their competitors would say that their beer was brewed with toilet water. But there's kind of this ick factor about water recycling. But the water is so clean when it's done that they have to add minerals back to give it some taste. And in Orange County, they put the water into groundwater basins, and it percolates for 6 months, and it's treated extensively. And it's an inexpensive form of water, and it's another really good way to move forward. And then the strategic improvements in water storage. I mean, we need more water storage, and we can do that without damming new rivers. But there's a push in our state to demolish dams rather than build new ones. Some of the dams being demolished don't really provide water storage as much as hydropower. But the fact is, demolishing dams and turning the rivers back into their natural state seems to be the goal of a large portion of the environmental community here. There are quite a few, quite a bit of evidence of environmentalists wanting the Central Valley, which has the most, the widest variety of agricultural land in the country. It's the most productive and varied agricultural land, that they would like a lot of that to go back to seed. And that's a lot of those places, like around Bakersfield and Fresno and Kings County. Those are extremely poor places. And to obliterate, the farm economy is really, really awful, right? So I refer In my book, I refer to Cadillac Desert, which is a great book, and it's you know, the seminal work on California water policy by Mark Reisner. But in his you know, in the afterword, he argues, quote, most people live in contained cancers called cities, and where more rural people would provide the opportunities for people from the cities to enjoy the region's splendors as they once were. This is what he's envisioning: a region where people begin to recognize that water left in rivers can be worth a lot more in revenues and jobs than water taken out of the rivers. Maybe even a region where a lot of people really don't give a damn how much money a river can produce. But that's vision. That's kind of this vision of letting more of our state just go back to the wild. But we have 40 million people living here. We're kind of the breadbasket of the world. And there's a great economic and social impact if we embrace those policies. And yet those are the policies that we seem to be embracing here in California.
Yeah, it's funny, the toilet to tap thing, I mean, whoever came up with it, just as a catchy phrase, should have like a second beach house or something. Perhaps they do. I do find it a little bemusing, because if you live in a city that is downstream from another city, which is pretty much all of them, unless you're in like, you know, mountains of Colorado or something, like where do you think your water's coming from? You know, I mean, there's, you know, runoff and other things from the prior city is going back into the river. And of course that used to be really bad, when there were no controls or attempt to try and, like, you know, wastewater treatment or other things like that. But, even now, you know, like I guarantee you that whatever treatments are going through that a city or a municipality or whatnot is doing in order to be able to reuse their water within the city, you're not getting anything better than that between cities, right? You know.
Well, right. The Earth's kind of a closed ecosystem, right? So it, we're not really creating more water. We're just recirculating what's already here.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Is there not any way to create more water? We had an episode a while back on geoengineering. Is there a way that we can seed the clouds both to limit the harmful rays from the sun, but also to maybe spark some more, not spark's not the right word, but to cause more rainfall?
You know, I have in the book a few like niche ideas, I call them, where in some underdeveloped countries, they have these new technologies to grab extra moisture out of the air, right? But my point before was that, you know, the whole atmosphere is kind of it all just recirculates, whether it comes from rain. And I'm not any sort of geologist, so correct me if I'm wrong here. But any water we use ultimately just goes into the ocean, and it comes up in rain, and it all gets recycled through our systems one way or the other. I don't spend a lot of time on those ideas. Not that they're bad ideas. I mean, they're necessarily, some of them are, there are all sorts of interesting technologies that ought to be pursued. And, but the bottom line, the simplest, least expensive way to do this, and it should mostly be done through revenue bonds, not through general obligation bonds, is just to expand our infrastructure where needed and capture more water. And look at that 50% that goes out to the sea. I think it's the Metropolitan Water District talks about the little sip, big gulp. So when we have really rainy years, try to take a little more out and store it. So in the middle of our drought, and I have the story in the book, I went out when I was with the San Diego Union Tribune. I went out to a water district in a rural area that involved the new Melones Dam, and the state and feds were both involved in largely emptying the contents of the dam in the middle of a historic drought to save what was going to amount to be a dozen hatchery raised fish that were going to be eaten by invasive species within a couple miles as they wiggled their way towards the Pacific Ocean. So that seems to be I don't know, it seems to epitomize what our battles are like. We fight over water flows to save a handful of fish, and the fish often aren't saved by that. In fact, the number of fish of endangered species are declining, even with the massive water flows that we've targeted, to flow freely through the rivers. What's needed is to save some of these habitats and restore habitats, and then separate out some of the water for human uses. So one of the things, I know you guys are in Texas, but the California Delta is always the place where the water fights begin and end, and that's the West Coast's largest estuary. If you turn California, a map of California on its side, all the water flows out of the rivers and into that area, that estuary, before it goes out to the Pacific Ocean. And there's been a push for, many years to the Sacramento River feeds into it from the north. And then there are pumps at the south end at the city called Tracy that pumps the water along the canals towards the Southern California metropolises. But it all gets tangled up in that estuary. And it's a really environmentally depleted area. So there was something, a proposal to build the, I think it was in the 80s, the peripheral canal, which would build a canal around that. But there was a statewide vote, and Southern Californians supported it by a modest amount. But Northern Californians, opposed it by almost, Saddam Hussein-like election levels, like 90% or more against it. So that never happened, but there's been a plan, a proposal to build twin tunnels that take the water under from the Sacramento River under the estuary and out to the pumps. Because what happens right now is at the pumps, if they find a delta smelt, which is an endangered species, then they shut down the pumps. So there's this effort to kind of restore some of the habitats in the delta, take some of the water underneath it through the tunnels, and make it less contingent on regulatory and court battles over endangered species. But that project is on life support right now. It's still technically going forward as a single tunnel, but it remains to be seen whether it will ever come to fruition. So,
My impression is that, at least with respect to California, a lot of water issues, they have a kind of Northern California versus Southern California rivalry. My impression may partly come from the old classic Jack Nicholson film, Chinatown, right? Which people may not remember actually, was really all about water and incest, but mostly about water. What is up with that? How do you resolve the, am I right in that impression? And how do you resolve that if I am right?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean Chinatown was focused on the Mulholland's use of sham buyers to buy land in the Owens Valley in the Eastern Sierras, which is the high desert region east of the Sierras, and then basically drained the lake down there to allow the development of the Los Angeles San Fernando Valley. So that it's a fascinating story. In Northern California, we get 2/3 of the rain up here and have in the top 1/3 of the state, and it's reversed. But the interesting thing was, during our drought, the Southern California water agencies have been really aggressive over the years at building water storage. And the San Diego Water Agency was actually, this was in the middle of the drought, was actually dumping water from its reservoirs because it had so much water. Meanwhile, up here where we have more rain but fewer reservoirs, there's it's a different political attitude up here. It's more growth averse than it is down there. So there's definitely that divide. I mean, even the conservatives that some of the folks that are conservative and support water infrastructure building They oppose the tunnels. They see it as a Southern California water grab. So you definitely feel that north-south tension. So I think I live not far from the Delta, and I don't think people up here are really pleased with my general support for building a tunnel like system, because it's right now it's kind of like a as one water official explained it to me, and it is true. It's like the 6-lane highway that runs into a series of dirt paths, and then the traffic has to find its way to the 4-lane highway at the end of the area. So it's a real tangled mess. So Northern Californians, they see it as a water grab, and the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California is now the biggest landholder in the Delta, which biggest taxpayer in the Delta. So that causes a lot of consternation.
So, well, first let me ask, you write 4 columns a week. Is that correct there, Steve?
Usually about 3. Yeah. And then a variety of other things. Here, so, yeah.
Right. So how do you do that?
I write probably, when you consider all the other, I do freelance writing and all. Yeah. So I write a northward of that every week. And I wrote the book on the side. In addition to doing, I did it on the weekends and evenings.
And you don't even, a lot of these people, like the big names that have a column and write books or whatever, most of at least, they have research assistants and they have ghostwriters and other things. The book, it's got some very beautiful, photographs in it, that are credited to a Steve Greenhut, you clearly wrote it yourself, and I know that because we talked about it that you did your own research too. So like, do you have like special time management secrets? And I also know that in addition to all this, you also your family raises goats, and so that is time consuming as well. But
and I'm a landlord.
So what?
I bet.
And you're a landlord.
I don't know.
That doesn't take any time. You just have to like collect money and then not respond when people call that their plumbing doesn't work.
Right. There are never any issues with the rental property. So I don't know. On the writing, I like to write, and it's so I get up early every morning, and I set deadlines for myself. And I just make sure I always have to have a deadline or 2 or 3, and I just get up and I pound it out, and then so that's what I do. And then I do I work for R Street, so I do we do lobbying and a lot of legislative work. It's not really a lot of actual lobbying, but I like to work. I get up early every morning, and I work late. And with the book, I took most of the pictures. So, and it's a big state. We're 800 miles north to south. So I had on weekends, I would get out and take the pictures. My priest wasn't happy because I didn't show up at church for a year. But
I couldn't want to go to church.
Well, I couldn't give up Sun. I mean, when you got 2 days a week of pure book time, you can't give up Sunday. And I guess I could have, but I wouldn't have got. Yeah, so I don't know. I like to write. I'm an efficient writer. I mean, having worked for a newspaper where you might do a couple, 3 articles in a day, I've worked for various newspapers. You're just used to doing it. And we're both the same way, Josiah. I mean, we're always thinking about things, our issue areas, and researching those areas. So when the writing comes, a lot of the times I've already done the research because I've already thought about it, read about it, talked to people. So then it becomes more of just a writing project than a starting from scratch. Oh my God, what am I going to talk about here? But the book, the book was it was a bit of a brain burn because I thought I knew about, I'm a journalist, so I'm not a water expert. So I thought I knew about, I knew the basics of water. I've been on the water tours with the water districts and been to the dams, and I've been to every one of our 58 counties. And I thought that I had some grasp of water. And then I start researching this. I'm like, oh my God, I don't know anything about water. It's such a big topic. So it was a little bit of a challenge, where my previous two books, I pretty much understood the pension system and had covered a lot of the eminent domain cases. So it wasn't as much learning that I had to do.
Yeah. Well, a good thing about the book is, even though it covers an often abstruse topic, you break it down in a very readable and understandable way. So, that's very important.
Oh, well, thanks for that. And a friend of mine who's an artist, he painted the original cover. So I was pretty happy with how that came out.
Do you want to talk about the goats or?
Oh, I don't mind. I'll talk about anything.
No, we don't have to cover the goats.
Yeah. I don't know. It's not my first goat rodeo.
Yeah. So, it was my daughter's project, the goats. So raising goats out here outside Sacramento, but,
I think that I have told, I do have a political story involving goats, which is, I may have told you at this, Steve, previously, but when I used to live in Indiana, I was involved with the local, the county Republican Party there, and we were having a primary for the congressional seat that was, at that time, it was held by a conservative Democrat, but it was a likely pickup for the Republicans, just because of the broader political trends. And anyway, so we sponsored a debate for the different congressional candidates. And one of the candidates during this debate attacked another one of the candidates and said that she had claimed on her campaign website that she owned 18 goats, but he had driven by her house. And it was in a more suburban area, and he said he estimated there's no way she could have had more than three or four goats in there.
What a scandal!
That's right. Yeah. In fact, he said, afterwards we were talking to him about it, and he's like, he didn't want to go negative, but he felt that if this information did not come out then, that the Democrats would use it against her in the general election, and so it was very important that people knew about. Had an accurate sense of how many goats she really owned. So how many? How many goats are we talking about here?
Well, we had 50 goats, and now we're down. My daughter's taken most of her herd to closer to where she lives, and so we're down. We haven't had this few goats that I could recall in 10 years. We're down to we just have four of them right now. We used to have we've had a horse or two. We've had llamas. We've had emus. So I now have as many cats as I have goats. So anyway, yeah. So we're empty nesters, and it's nice to be able to go away on the weekend and to have to feed them all. But you know what? On your story's hilarious. But here, I live in an exurb of Sacramento, so we're not that far from Sacramento, but it's a rural ranching area just outside the end of the suburban sprawl. And the local, the local Facebook group, people are, it's all obsessed about animals. I could totally see how that could be a scandal. People are always chiming in about people's animals. So, animals are in communities like this, you better be honest about your animals, I guess.
I guess so.
Especially if you have political ambitions.
Right, yes, especially if you have political ambitions. All right, so the book is Winning the Water Wars. It's available now. Steve Greenhut, my friend and colleague, has been our guest, and Thank you very much for joining us, Steve.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.